Hey folks, just a quick reminder that this episode is not meant to be used for medical advice, just good old-fashioned education. All patient information has been modified to protect their identity, and the views expressed in our podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinion of our employers.
Okay, hello everyone. Welcome back, Clinical Problem Solvers, to a special episode of Women in Diagnosis, WDX. My name is Maddalena Conti. I'm a medical student at Hofstra in New York City and a CP Solvers team member. And today is a special WDX episode because we will be talking about mistakes and setbacks in medicine. And I'm really grateful for the three incredible people I have here, all at different levels of training, who will be joining this discussion to talk about mistakes and setbacks in medicine. So would love, you know, for them to introduce themselves. Maybe we'll start with Dr. Ashley McMullen, and you could introduce yourself and also, you know, share why do you think it's important to talk about mistakes and setbacks in medicine.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for the invitation. I am a diehard CPS fan, so super excited to be a part of this crew. As was stated, my name is Ashley McMullen. I'm an assistant professor of medicine at UCSF, and I practice primary care over at the San Francisco VA. I also serve in a leadership role within our UCSF IM residency, so I am the faculty residency diversity lead. Why do I think it's important to talk about these things? I think, you know, this topic for me is, you know, one that I find extremely meaningful for many reasons, but particularly because we all make mistakes. And I think it's important to normalize that and humanize ourselves as we strive to humanize our patients. And I think acknowledging that mistakes are made and it's okay, and we can move past them and learn from them and take some of the fear and shame out of it.
Yeah, no, thank you. I couldn't agree more. And I think, you know, from my own personal experiences, setbacks can often feel so isolating, even though we know that others make it. So completely agree with what you're saying. So thank you. And thank you for being here. Next, we have Dr. Simone Weiss. I would love for you to introduce yourself as well, and then share, you know, again, what do you think the value is in talking about mistakes?
Thanks so much. My name is Simone. I am a third year family and community medicine resident at UCSF and San Francisco General. I think in this space, the clinical problem solvers, I should say I'm also a clinical problem solvers team member. I work mostly on the space learning series and the clinical unknown series, but I'm so excited to be here today. I think in this space where we mostly center talking about our, like, showcasing our skills and showcasing our knowledge and our intellect, that's just like such a small part of the story. And it's like, we need to tell the whole story, and the whole story is that we all struggle and fail. And when we don't tell that part of the story, then we run the risk of further excluding people who are just like living real lives and having real struggles by making it seem like the people who they are hearing from aren't. And so I think if we're going to change medicine and make medicine a space that, you know, kind of better reflects our society and better reflects the patients we're taking care of, then we need to be more authentic in the version of ourselves that we put forward.
I absolutely love that. Thank you for articulating that so beautifully. And then I would love, Jane, if you could unmute again, introduce yourself, and why do you think it's important to talk about setbacks in medicine?
Yeah. Hi, I'm Jane. I'm a fourth year medical student currently at Boston University School of Medicine. Why I think it's important, I think that a lot of the setbacks and mistakes that we face in medicine isn't talked about enough. And I think a lot of the things that we experience can be learning, you know, good learning for everyone around us. And I think, you know, we need to break the stigma of sharing these experiences with others.
Jane, thank you for articulating that. And, you know, Ashley, Simone, Jane, thank you all so much for being here again. So the theme for the discussion today is I thought I was alone. And I think this is a helpful topic because, as you all have shared, making mistakes and going through setbacks in medicine can feel so isolating, even though likely people at all levels of training make mistakes on a, if not a weekly, you know, if not a daily, maybe a weekly basis. And we all feel alone sometimes. And so I think it can be helpful to share these stories to know that we're not alone. And then also practically, how can we learn from others in terms of what helped them get through it? So, you know, without further ado, let's dive in. And Ashley, I would love to start with you, if that's okay. And what story comes to mind when you hear that phrase, I thought I was alone?
Yeah, happy to start. So yeah, I think when I hear the phrase, I thought I was alone, it brings up a lot of stories for me. And I think, you know, particularly in the context of primary care, because I think that in some respects, primary care compared to inpatient, when we're working in teams, can feel like a lonely vocation. And, you know, I had one particular experience that stands out to me. Full disclaimer, I actually shared parts of the story on my own podcast, The Human Doctor, but I'll add a little bit more context for this episode. And so, and again, as someone who's made plenty of mistakes, this is just one example, but, you know, I want to share this one for a number of reasons, which I'll get into, but this experience took place in my last year of residency. So as a third year resident in a primary care continuity clinic, and it was a clinic that I was staffing in the evening time. So we had some time allotted for folks to come in after hours. And at that time in my training, I remember being particularly burnt out and just pretty exhausted at that point in the year. And so, you know, I was already kind of entering the evening clinic in a kind of low energy state. I had a patient scheduled that night who was someone who was relatively young and healthy. They'd come in and kind of were exhibiting what I characterized at that time as a lot of kind of health-related anxiety. So, you know, a person who had some symptoms, looked them up online, had certain ideas of what was going on, and some things kind of made sense, some didn't. And I remember my attitude at the time was just feeling a little annoyed, to be completely transparent. And so the symptoms that they had mentioned, I remember kind of, you know, explaining some stuff, not really taking it that seriously. I'd ordered a couple tests that I thought were important, but was really trying to move on to my next visit. And so I ended the visit with that patient, didn't really think much about them until I got notification a couple weeks after the fact that that patient had come back and had seen another provider. That provider ordered a pretty simple test for those symptoms that the patient was describing. I'm being purposely vague to protect their identity. But it was a diagnosis that was made that I should have made at that point in my career. It was a very simple diagnosis that I missed. And so I remember at that time feeling pretty bad. I didn't, but I didn't do much else with that information afterwards. The diagnosis had been made and shared with the patient. And so I kind of moved on. And so fast forward 2 years later, I had done my chief year, and then I'm starting very brand new on faculty. And I had gotten a grant through the School of Medicine to do some work in narrative medicine, which is what I do now, which is the process of integrating storytelling into the medical space and using that as a way of understanding and connecting across differences and providing better care for our patients. And so I had done some promotional videos talking about my ideas. And those videos have been posted on a public UCSF account. And that patient saw those videos and sent me an email 2 years later, basically calling me out for not practicing what I was preaching, saying that in that visit, she had felt dismissed and that it didn't seem like I had taken the time to get to know her as an individual. And again, this was years later, and I remember reading that email and feeling like a solid punch in my gut. And what I felt most poignantly was shame. I felt ashamed that, you know, here I am kind of embarking on this new career, trying out this new trajectory in medical humanities, and, you know, I treated this patient like this. Not only did I make a mistake in missing the diagnosis, I made someone feel unseen and unheard. And that, to me, is the opposite of what I try to do in medicine. And so I acknowledged that the patient was correct in calling me out, and I apologized. But I felt very alone in my shame, and also questioned whether or not I should even be, you know, doing what I do. And so I carried that with me, you know, at the early part of my career. And one thing that was really healing for me. So I have a mentor here at the VA. And again, early in my career, I was meeting regularly with faculty mentors. And so this is a person who is like, you know, a mentor of mentors. So I always come with like an agenda kind of prepared and things that I'm hoping to talk about and work on. And a couple weeks after I had gotten this message, I had a meeting with this mentor, and I had no intention of talking about this. I hadn't told anybody. And so I was like, you know, kind of scrambling to kind of come up with an agenda, make sure that I showed up again, looking like I knew what I was doing or what I was going to talk about. And we sat down, and she just simply asked me how I was doing. And I just burst into tears, like could not really hold it back. And this mentor, I like might choke up a little bit just talking about it, because, you know, she didn't flinch at my tears. She wasn't uncomfortable at my discomfort. She simply sat still and told me, "I can handle your tears." And, you know, I shared with her how I was feeling and how ashamed I was. And what she did was not only affirm that it was okay, she then proceeded to share a very deeply personal story about something that she had been going through early in her career that I had no idea. And I was very surprised actually to hear it. This is someone who I admired supremely and still do. But, you know, she had struggled with some things early on that caused her a lot of shame and a lot of pain too. And, you know, it's for me, like, it was hard to describe what I felt in that moment, but just being seen and feeling validated. And not only that, but being able to share. I talked about this with Kimberly Manning, but, you know, kind of sharing in this fellowship of, you know, of pain and also suffering that comes with this job and, you know, trying to do right by our patients. But, you know, the reality is we're humans too. We're tired. We don't know it all. And sometimes we don't show up correctly. And, you know, the expectation that we are, you know, on game all the time is just not realistic. And she really modeled that for me. I've had this happen with mentors before where I've like, you know, felt alone and a mistake, and they shared something that had happened with them. And both times, or several times where this has happened, it's been transformational for me. So again, it just affirms the need to continue having conversations like this. So thanks again to you guys for organizing this. And yeah, after that conversation, I really was able to kind of move forward. And I've made mistakes since then. But, you know, it was a lot to be learned from that. And not the least of which, you know, I'm extremely grateful for that patient, for the courage to call me out, appropriately so. And I remember that vividly, and also give myself grace too. to check my pulse before I go into the room and knowing where I'm at. And, you know, it's a little easier to show up humanistically as an attending, I will say. But yeah, recognizing that, you know, there's an energy that we bring into the room as well. And, you know, we can't always shut off our personal life or what's going on inside when we're taking care of patients.
Yeah, Ashley, thank you for sharing that. I have kind of a few kind of immediate thoughts from that. One is just sometimes how powerful the question, how are you doing, can be. Mm-hmm. I have had an experience in my life quite a few times with mentors where I'm going into someone's office for, you know, a different reason, maybe just asking a question in office hours, and they ask, how are you doing? And there's just an unloading. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting just how much we hold on to that we're not always aware of. That just comes out when you have mentors who are so present with you. And as you spoke about, just really make you feel seen and validated. So I can definitely identify with that aspect of it. And I'm sure a lot of people can as well. I'm curious, after having gone through that and being able to speak with that with your mentor, how has that changed the way you deal with similar experiences going forward?
I guess with regards to kind of that specific interaction or that specific experience, I think that I have a little bit more built-in time for like self-awareness, recognizing, you know, if I am kind of, you know, in a running low on steam, if I'm in a state of exhaustion or whatever, you know, or there's certain aspects of the patient that might, you know, tip off like kind of potential for bias, that I kind of call that out within myself early on, recognizing, okay, like I need to just be extra mindful of how I'm feeling today. And kind of, you know, check the pulse before I go into the room, so I know that maybe I need to just circle back or spend a little extra time with this patient, or just be mindful that, you know, there are some things that I might miss or potentially gloss over just if I'm feeling a little distracted that day. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Of 100%, definitely. Yeah, thank you. Mm-hmm. Simone, Jane, I wanted to see if you had any kind of immediate reflections to that you wanted to share.
I was getting choked up the whole time you were talking because, first of all, I'm also going to talk about the loneliness of primary care, even though we didn't plan for that. But also, because you articulated this tension that I feel like I have been feeling for the last year or two that has been hard to name, which is, you know, we talk about imposter syndrome a lot in its relationship to other people, but I think like the imposter syndrome of feeling like there's this version of myself that like I view myself as, and that I think other people view me as in the kind of doctor that I am. But then there's the version that the patients who see me on my worst days see me as, and like, you know, the days that you're dismissive or not totally present because you've got three other people waiting, or just, you know, the days where you're just not the kind of doctor you want to be. And, I sometimes feel really like overwhelmed and scared by the fact that I'm like, do people know that I'm actually like a really bad doctor sometimes? And obviously that's not like my core belief about myself as a doctor, but it is something that's there sometimes. And it felt really validating to hear you name that, because I think it's like a truth about yourself. I always think that the only people who know this about me are me and the interpreters that I use, like my in-person interpreters who have like seen me through so many visits, are the only people who have seen this. And when somebody else is in the room, it changes who you are actually too. And so it's probably only me who sees this. And that can feel really scary to know that like, you don't always show up as the best version of yourself, and people notice it, and you like learning how to forgive yourself for it, but also be cognizant of it and minimize it is definitely a struggle. And I really appreciated hearing you talk about it.
Certainly. Yeah, Simone, I feel you. Yeah, especially in training, there's so many competing responsibilities. But I think, you know, one of the things that I again value in storytelling is that, you know, it kind of brings us more into like a holistic view of ourselves. I think you know, one of the sad aspects of medicine is we often feel like we have to check certain parts of our identities at the door and show up, you know, professional and polished and confident because that's what we think our patients want from us, which to a certain extent, I think, yes and no. But I think our patients also want to know that there are human beings taking care of them too. And sometimes, I've felt a little bit more, confident with this as an attending, but, you know, I will sometimes let my patients know, you know, I'm running on the listing today. So forgive me if I feel a little, if I seem a little distracted, just, you know, let me know. And yeah, that hasn't backfired since, but yeah, I just, you know, just affirming and acknowledging that we're not, if we're showing up holistically as we should, it's not always going to be perfect.
Agreed. Thank you again, Ashley, for so beautifully sharing that. Simone, I would love to see if you've also had a story related to that and, you know, what comes to mind when you hear, I thought I was alone.
Yeah, I had a lot of thoughts in trying to figure out which topic of aloneness I wanted to talk about, actually. And I thought I might be transparent about some of the ideas I like cycled through before I landed on primary care being incredibly lonely. The first thing that I thought of was the feeling of aloneness in moving across the country for intern year, especially during COVID. It was really hard to sort of set up roots in a new city when the whole city was closed in 2020, and intern year felt very alone sometimes because of that. The other thing that crossed my mind to talk about was in second year, when I started senioring, on my first day of senioring, I had a patient who had like a very tragic death, code and death on my first day of senioring. And I started having panic attacks right afterwards, basically in a way that I had never had before. I thought about talking about that. And then I thought about talking about the feeling of being an intern alone at night on labor and delivery and the sheer fear of like not knowing what the heck I'm doing and like of causing harm. But what I landed on was the feeling that's feeling most salient right now for me, which is this feeling of aloneness in primary care, which comes kind of in two flavors for me. One is this feeling as a trainee in, I work at San Francisco General, which is the county hospital of San Francisco. And our community is very marginalized and very under-resourced. And there are some things our patients don't have access to because of insurance and many other societal harms. But also sometimes I worry that there are things that if somebody else was taking care of them and not a trainee, like maybe they would be just a little bit better. And so there's that feeling of aloneness and guilt from that. But the times that I feel most alone are when my patients are in crisis and I feel alone with the weight of those decisions. My clinical like passion is the care of pregnant and postpartum people with substance use disorders. I really, really love taking care of this population. I feel like being able to see people in their best moments really changes the way that you're able to show up for them on their worst days. And I really love it. Oftentimes there are ups and downs and roller coasters and crises that come up specifically to name it. Like the involvement of Child Protective Services is very present in these patients' lives, and the tension of what's best for mom and what's best for baby and whether or not CPS needs to be involved is a decision that often comes to the PCP and other providers. My personal view on CPS is like there is a place for it, and it is broadly a harmful institution that is like serves to police Black and brown patients, especially in the context that I work in. And so like broadly really don't like CPS being involved, and often they are. And the weight of those decisions when safety is there feels really hard to hold, especially as a trainee, and happens to me a lot. I guess I'll give an example to illustrate it. And then maybe I'll talk a bit about how I'm working through it. I have a family who I take care of, several generations of the family. And I was there for a baby's birth, and I take care of multiple generations. And in the past year, I've had instances where one person in the family has called me to tell me that another person in the family is in crisis and that they're worried about the kid's safety and that I need to call CPS. And I have felt so alone in those moments. They obviously only happen at night when I don't have the immediate surroundings of my co-residents and attendings. And I can see a world in which there's real danger of safety to the child. And I can certainly see a world where there is a real danger of causing harm to a family that is making it through and leading them to spiral by involving the surveillance state. And so I have felt super alone. And I feel like there's also a pressure in talking about it to be and here's the solution I came up with. And I don't have a solution. And I recognize that there's fallacy in this idea that I'm actually alone. I'm a trainee. I can always call my attendings. I can call, and I do. And still that's not meant to invalidate for myself or for others. It still feels like you're alone when somebody turns to you with a decision that you feel like you can't make. I think what I've learned through all of this is that when I feel like I have to make a decision from a place of aloneness or anxiety or fear, where I land is a decision that is probably more paternalistic and more conservative and not about what's best for my patient, but what makes me feel the most comfortable. And so what I have been trying really hard to do is remove that aspect from my decision-making. And what that's looked like kind of more tangibly is I have one or two attendings who work with a similar community of patients who, when these things happen, even if it's at night, I will call them to tell them, not because I want them to tell me what to do, but because the experience of actually just saying out loud the circumstance and sharing it with another provider and feeling the weight of that decision is not on me, even after just saying what's going on, with this family, after I called my attending and told her kind of here's what's happening, I'm feeling really torn about this. And as I spoke it out, it sort of clarified for me what felt right. And actually it's happened three or four times this year where when I've gotten to the verge of being okay, I actually do think this is a situation where I need to call CPS. And all of those times after I've spoken to somebody else and just shared it, I've actually not called and have felt, and now looking back, those have felt the right decisions to make. And so I think the feeling of aloneness can push us to places that are not good for us and not good for our patients. And I'm learning how to create community around me so that that's not where my decisions are coming from.
Yeah, thank you, Simone. I think there's a lot of courage in sharing what you just shared. And I think in medicine, I just finished my third year medical school. So I have not been in a situation where I've had to make such, big decisions like that. But I know that at all stages of medicine, medical training, you have these points where you need to make challenging decisions. And what you just showed is just kind of this level of self-awareness in the traps that you can fall under when you're in a situation like that, kind of like what you said, the risk of responding in a more paternalistic way, et cetera. And so I think what you shared in terms of reaching out to someone more superior to you and attending and just being able to say it, you're thinking out loud, not necessarily asking exactly what to do, and was for me really helpful to hear. So thank you for that. Ashley or Jane, do you have any kind of immediate reflections from what Simone shared or any thoughts?
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that, Simone. I think one thing that really kind of made me reflect from your story is, as I kind of get more experience in my training, I start to realize the decisions that we make are really consequential to the patients that we're taking care of. They can be life or death, and especially in a lot of these social situations, they can be really, really challenging as well. And so, throughout our training, we have this mindset of, being self-sufficient and being able to, you know, make decisions for ourselves and figure things out, problem solve on our own. And that's supposed to be seen as a strength. But, you know, as you mentioned, Simone, like there's strength in numbers as well and being able to share experiences and problem solving in groups. So I think that was something that I really appreciated from your story, Simone.
I 100% agree, Jane, and I just want to, you know, put a shout out to our listeners that we don't want to discourage anybody from primary care. You know, it can feel lonely at times, but I think that, you know, to your point, sometimes, you know, it's a matter of kind of getting out of our own way and recognizing that primary care is still a team sport. And it should be, because, you know, it's a lot of responsibility, and your story, Simone, is so beautiful in its humility and recognizing that it is hard to balance these aspects of patient and child safety with patient autonomy, and, you know, trying to do what's best, was also recognizing that we are working within a very broken system. And a lot of times that falls on the shoulders of the healthcare providers, where, you know, our social safety nets, you know, just aren't there. You know, your patients are lucky to have a provider who recognizes that and takes that into account. And of course, you know, you have folks around you, and sometimes just talking things through, exactly like you said, can really make the difference. So I appreciate you bringing that to this conversation.
Great point, Ashley. Primary care is excellent. Taking care of patients is a huge privilege, and I love primary care. And there are parts that are hard. Jane, what you said about medical training, like training us that like being individualistic and self-sufficient is like a value, is such a, thank you for putting it that way. Like it's such a harmful value to instill in trainees that like that is how they'll succeed. Because in fact, like not a single aspect of medicine functions in that way. And I think it is really a flaw of our training that's what we lead ourselves to believe and then have to spend so much time like unlearning once we move to practice.
Yeah, I think I just feel like I want to leave that reflection as it stands, because I cannot agree more. And I think Jane, you said it so beautifully. So thank you for articulating it in that way. Jane, I would actually love to, you know, transition to you and see what story you would like to share related to the topic, I Thought I Was Alone.
Yeah. So when I was thinking about this topic, you know, one of my kind of most salient experiences came to mind, which actually happened during my PhD, which is not in medicine, but I do think that a lot of the feelings that I had and things that I went through does apply to, you know, medicine as well. And I feel like a lot of trainees feel the same thing. So this happened during my fourth year of my PhD, so about a year before I actually graduated. You know, I was trying to wrap things up, but my project wasn't going the way that I wanted it to. And at the end of my fourth year, I had my thesis committee meeting coming up. So my thesis committee is basically my PI and then a couple of other faculty members who kind of decide, you know, am I on the right track, and will I be ready to graduate in a year? So this meeting was kind of a big deal. And at this point, you know, my PhD had kind of been smoldering for a couple years. Things weren't going super well. And I knew that going into the meeting, it would be a pretty difficult discussion in terms of, you know, will I be able to graduate in a year? But I did my best. You know, I showed up for the meeting, presented all my data that I had. And then usually what happens is the faculty will kind of kick you out for a little bit and they'll do their little discussion. And then they'll call me back in. So they kicked me out after my presentation, and it took them about, I would say, like maybe a half hour, which felt like forever for me, for them to discuss. And they brought me back in and they told me that they felt like I was not ready, and that they felt like I would need an extra year. And so that would end up being 6 years of a PhD. And so, you know, after that meeting, I had a feeling that was going to happen, but to be faced with the reality of it was really hard. And at that point, you know, I felt, you know, all the things that we feel when we, you know, get rejected or make a mistake. I felt like a failure. I felt like I let everyone down. And I was like, what am I going to do now? You know, like, I don't want to spend 6 years of my life on this PhD. I want to move on. I think at that point, my project was mine. And so I felt like it was my responsibility to figure everything out. But my PI, she, you know, she asked me to kind of reach out to other people and see if they could help me out. So one of the first people I reached out to was my MD PhD directors. And I hadn't talked to them in years, basically. You know, I would say hi once in a while, but they didn't really actually know what was going on. And so when I reached out to them and told them about my situation, they were so supportive, and they just like helped me come up with a game plan, and kind of helped me think about ways that I could kind of pivot my project and make something work out for the next year. And one of my MD PhD directors, I remember very vividly, we had set up kind of a meeting, and basically he just listened to everything that I was feeling at the moment. He was like, just tell me what's going on, and we'll get through this together. And he reminded me, he was like, I believe in you and I think you can do this. And just a little something like that just made me feel so much better. And I think, you know, throughout those kind of smoldering years of my PhD, I just felt so alone. But I didn't realize that if I had just reached out to someone, you know, I really am not. And a lot of people feel the same way, especially in academia.
Yeah, thank you, Jane, for sharing that. I think that's what you shared. Actually, I see a lot of threads from Simone's story as well, and actually the reflection that you made earlier about this in training, kind of the reinforcement that we get to, you know, be strong and push through things on our own, and oftentimes without reaching out for help or reaching out, you know, to collaborate with others. And I think one, I just want to acknowledge the courage that it takes to share a story like that. And just knowing that you are not alone. And I know that you probably made a lot of other people not feel alone. I mean, I didn't do a PhD, but I've had my own struggles in terms of exams and rotation grades. And even though you know other people have likely gone through it, it's still amazing how isolating it can feel. And so by you speaking that and kind of normalizing sharing, you know, when things don't go exactly as you planned is really powerful. So just kind of can't thank you enough for the courage that it took to share that. What I'm really curious about is you talked about, you know, what helped you get through that and reaching out to your, you know, the director, but I'm curious kind of if there was anything else that helped you move through that challenging period that you want to share?
Yeah, I think after that happened, there was a lot of self-reflection. And I think it was actually a great kind of turning point, I would say, in thinking about my career and about success. I think I really had to think about what does success really mean to me, and what do I really want from my career? You know, does success mean being at the, you know, the very best in my field? Does it mean like I have to reach the top of the top? Or does success mean, you know, being fulfilled in my life and finding meaning in the work that I do, no matter what it is? And I think it really helped me find a more healthy perspective on what I want to do in my life. At that point, I was like, what do I want in my life? You know, who am I if medicine and science was like completely stripped away? Like, who am I at my core? You know, what do I want from my life at my core? And to me, it's like, I want to be a good human. I want to help others, and I want to, you know, love others. And with that perspective, I think, you know, going through setbacks made it a little bit easier in that way.
Yeah, I'm picking a lot of a lot of what you said is sitting with me. So just thank you so much. Simone or Ashley, any reflections to Jane's story at all you want to share?
I mean, I've been on mute, but I've been over here just like, like, you know, the whole time. I feel like Jane has given us a seminar on, you know, on humanism, particularly in academia. I really resonate so much with everything that you just said, but particularly like, you know, like, as was mentioned before, just the courage to ask for help and, you know, breaking out of the mindset that that is not a sign of weakness or surrender. You know, it's a necessary part of this work that we do. And again, this myth of the healthcare hero as, you know, the autonomous being that saves the day or, you know, gets the project done, you know, it doesn't do any service to us or our patients. And then to your point also, Jane, I think, you know, it is both the difficulty and also the beauty of setbacks, that those are really the opportunities for us to reevaluate our relationship to our work. And one of the things that I found probably, you know, later than I would have loved to realize, but also born out of, you know, tragic life circumstances, was, you know, asking this question of like, you know, who am I apart from what I do? I think we often get caught up in defining ourselves by, you know, our success and our achievements. You know, the first thing we do when people ask us to introduce ourselves is list our credentials, and, you know, and sometimes we don't ever take the time to pause and ask ourselves, like, who are we really? And what is it that truly gives us life to our core? And the fact that you were able to pivot from the situation and then do that is just such a sign of strength and maturity. So I'm really grateful to have you here and be able to hear this story. So thank you for sharing.
I really resonated with your sort of discussion of like fourth year being a time of defining for yourself what success was and what you wanted out of your career. I remember deciding what kind of medicine I wanted to practice. And I'm from the East Coast, and there's a big cultural difference coastally between about how family medicine is perceived. And like, just to name it, I think the East Coast has a really unhealthy perception of family medicine, in that I was told many times in med school, like, oh, you're too smart to do family medicine. And I think it's like incredibly harmful practice that many people hold. And I remember feeling really torn about picking this as a specialty, because I was like, this is the work I want to do, but I've just spent like almost 30 years being trained in this like system of, you know, pursue the most prestigious and like work harder and get to the top. And which in and itself is flawed, but you become the system that you grew up in, you know? And so I remember feeling like really existentially challenged by this decision to like do family medicine despite many of my like very close mentors in medical school telling me that like I shouldn't do it and kind of looking down on it. And I remember it, fourth year being a time of really redefining like, okay, but what is the work that I want to do and what is it that I want out of medicine? And so hearing you talk about it again really brought me back to that. So thank you.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with what you all shared. And just sitting here, I have just grown from hearing all your stories or definitely been kind of inspired to do my own self-reflection. So I really can't thank you all enough for one, taking the time, but also just the courage as we kind of keep going back to lean into the reflection of these stories, but also sharing them out loud, which is not easy by any means. So just so much gratitude to all of you. Thank you so much. And I did want to let, anyone who's listening to this, who, has a story that they wanted to share, you know, this, the Setbacks in Medicine is a series that we're working on. And once a month, we're trying to have these live, kind of like virtual morning report style discussions, but not virtual morning report. It's just people sharing their stories and kind of what's helped them get through setbacks. So in the episode description, I'll include a link that you can click on to express your interest if you're ever interested in that. But I just wanted to thank you all again. And Ashley, Simone, Jane, if you please feel free to unmute if you have any last thoughts. If not, oh yeah, go ahead, Simone.
I was just going to say that it's felt very healing to be in this space with all of you, and I've really enjoyed hearing your stories and sharing with you. So thank you for making the space for us to do this.
Likewise.
Awesome. Okay. Well, thanks, everyone. We'll see you next time.
That's a wrap, folks.